On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
2 minutes past 11 on June the 6th, 2021. It is a Sunday of the June bank holiday weekend, but it's Gavin Riley still with you here as always this Sunday morning for the next 2 hours on the record here on News Talk. 53106 is the number for your text. We're also on Twitter. Our hashtag is on the record NT. Very busy morning as always. I'll have a quick browse through the front pages of this morning's newspapers. I'm going to leave the Sunday Times until last and I'll explain why in just a couple of minutes. We'll start though with the Sunday Independent. Varadkar's message: spend big and keep spending. Taoiseach De Leo Varadkar has told the Irish public to avoid thrift and to start spending the €12 billion in household savings this summer to kickstart the economy. In the wake of the government's €4 billion stimulus plan and ahead of the reopening of the hospitality sector tomorrow, although clearly there's a lot of the hospitality sector that seems to be operating in some sort already, Leo Varadkar has urged consumers to spend big on clothes, household goods and repairs, nights out and weekends away in order to help the economy and employment to recover from the devastation wrought by the COVID-19 pandemic. Writing in today's Sunday Independent, the Enterprise Minister predicts that economic growth could break all records in the next 3 months, allowing the economy to take off like a rocket and to help restore the public finances. Also on the front page of the Sunday Independent, and we might get to this in the course of the next hour, that religious orders who featured in the Mother and Baby Homes Commission report have yet to commit to contributing to the redress scheme for survivors of those institutions. Roderick O'Gorman, the Children's Minister, wrote to the religious orders after the report was published in January, but nearly 6 months later he says they have not yet given him a commitment to contribute to the redress scheme, details of which he will bring to Cabinet in the coming weeks. Probably not all that surprising that they are a bit loath or reluctant to sign up to any redress scheme, given what we saw Mary Daly say during the week, that some of the religious orders are still to this day dissenting to the description of some of the burial situations in some of those homes. Front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday this morning, the CEO and founder of Supermax, Pat McDonagh, is not happy about the pandemic unemployment payment, not alone because it exists, but also because he has accused students and foreign workers of falsely claiming it. He has claimed that Asian and Eastern European workers who quit the hospitality sector are still claiming the €350 COVID dole payment, as it's called here, even though they're now in their home countries. He says some of those overseas guys, they're probably working back home as well. €350 a week in India or Pakistan is the equivalent to €1,500 here, so why would they come back if they can get it lodged into their account every week? He also said that he knew of college students collecting the PUP while still working on the black market. His criticism comes as the Mail on Sunday today reveals that a designated tout line, their words, has been set up to allow employers to tip off the authorities about former employees who have opted to stay on the PUP rather than returning to their jobs. Reminded of somebody standing in front of a placard saying "Welfare cheats cheat us all" and how well that went down at the time. Front page of the Business Post this morning: broadband rollout target slashed as contractor admits delays. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses which were due to get high-speed broadband this year will miss out as the National Broadband Plan is falling far short of its targets despite recent assurances that the rollout was on schedule. Just 4,000 homes and businesses have been reached in the first half of this year out of a target of 115,000 by the end of 2021. National Broadband Ireland, the company that was awarded the contract, has now cut its target for this year in half to pass 50,000 to 60,000 premises in what is likely to be a significant blow to rural communities anxiously awaiting new high-speed broadband connections so that they can engage in remote working and other online activities more effectively. What's remarkable about that is on two fronts. Firstly, that when COVID broke out, Richard Bruton, who was the communications minister at the time, was talking up the idea of accordioning the programme down so that it might be done within 6 years rather than seven because of the demand that there would be for high-speed internet. What's also remarkable is that a lot of the construction work on the broadband plan was not disrupted by COVID. It was considered to be one of the essential projects and therefore was allowed to continue throughout a lot of the national lockdowns. So despite that, still a relatively small number of households passed so far. Also on the front page of the Business Post, and this is discussed at length in a lot of newspapers today, the G7 group's push for a minimum global corporate tax rate of 15% must meet the needs of smaller countries, according to the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue. The G7 group of leading economies agreed yesterday to back American proposals for a minimum global corporate tax rate of 15% in what's been hailed as a historic and unprecedented deal. Speaking from London, because he was attending that meeting as president of the Eurogroup, that's the block of Euro-using countries, Pascal Donoghue said that the agreement by the G7 finance ministers was an important signpost for the changes in global corporate tax policy that are coming down the road. The G7 agreement is an important signpost and it does have consequences for the future of corporate tax policy across the world, but this agreement is just another step in the process, he said. Also, the Business Post tells us revenue, when they are collecting the property tax next year, will also be given powers to collect data on vacant homes, which could potentially be of use when it comes to the state's response to the housing crisis. Finally, for now, the front page of the Sunday Times, which I said I was going to leave until last. Pascal Donoghue again is there saying that he will pledge to fight to keep Ireland's 12.5% corporate tax rate, despite that deal among the G7 to have a minimum rate of 15%. Also, if you're looking for some magic beans to buy this Sunday morning, the British government is once again committed in principle to building a tunnel across the Irish Sea. But the front page story on the Sunday Times is Gardaí under fire after baton charging drinkers. The government, Gardaí and Dublin City Council have faced renewed criticism for failing to plan for an outdoor summer after more chaotic scenes in the capital streets on Friday when officers baton charged a group of youths who had been drinking. Gardaí said there were a number of public organised incidents involving large organised groups congregating on South William Street, St Stephen's Green and Temple Bar Square. While officers were dealing with a group in South William Street, glass bottles and other missiles were thrown at them. Having attempted to engage with these persons with no positive response, uniformed Gardaí, supported by Soft Cap Public Order Gardaí, then dispersed this particular group, the force said. 14 people had been arrested for public order offences. Now, this refers to events on Friday night, and there have been more disturbances again, as I mentioned, in the city centre last night, with 19 people arrested. There has been a Garda press conference this morning where we've been hearing from the Assistant Commissioner for the Dublin Metropolitan Region. Her name is Anne-Marie Cagney. She was asked about the degree to which these gatherings had been organised, as was described by the Gardaí last night. Let's take a listen.
It's not coordinated in the sense that we see it coordinated on social media. What we are saying is it's a group of like-minded young individuals, you know, predominantly male, who are coming into the city and causing trouble. And again, just to reiterate, like, we will not accept that kind of behaviour. It is not fair on the good citizens of Dublin to have that behaviour on their doorsteps.
Anne-Marie Cagney, who is the Assistant Commissioner for the Dublin Region, was also asked about the deployment of the public order units into the city centre last night and whether that was proportionate given what was going on.
Our response throughout the course of our policing activities has been a graduated response. If you see last night's response again, that is part of a defensive response that we put in place. It's again to protect our members. We've had three members of An Garda Síochána injured over this weekend, and I will not tolerate that. My job as Assistant Commissioner is to provide safety and security for our members as well as the community. And in that regard, those shields will provide that additional protection for our members.
That is Anne-Marie Cagney there, the Assistant Commissioner for the Dublin Metropolitan Region, speaking to reporters outside the Garda premises in Harcourt Square this morning. I'm joined in studio to go through this morning's papers by Philip Ryan, the political editor with the Irish Independent, and also by Sinead O'Carroll, who's the editor of the Journal.ie and who was looking a little bit perplexed as she heard Anne-Marie Cagney speaking there. Why so, Sinead?
It just sounded a bit finger-waggy, and I'm actually very much on, not on the fence, but I just think this conversation around South William Street and everything that's happening in Dublin City Centre just needs a lot more nuance and less black and white sentiments, because Brendan O'Connor actually puts it really well on the front page of the Sunday Independent today. In a question he's asked, do we actually want to have a festival in the city centre at weekends? And I think there is an interesting question there when we talk about an outdoor summer. Like, we don't necessarily, why are we all jumping to that means drinking outside? And I know I sound like an old fart when I say that, but you know, there is a question to be asked there. I was actually in Dublin myself, contradicting myself, last night, and it was actually lovely.
You live pretty centrally though.
I do live centrally, and I was in town all day, and then we were having a drink outside on Faith Street. And we actually saw the public order unit arrive, all five vans, and walk out. They actually walked through Faith Street because it was, the crowd was quite dispersed on Faith Street and everything was very calm there. And they obviously walked towards South William Street where they started to disperse people. And that's where the questions arise. We then walked down Camden Street, which was really empty. And I kind of felt sorry for all the takeaway pint vendors there, because if actually we just dispersed. Mm. And that's probably some of the bad decisions, the bad planning. Everyone is going to South William Street because young people know that they're getting a good atmosphere there. Whereas if we create better places further afield, like Brendan says in his piece as well, like, we do have spaces that could be more controlled. Like, this all goes down to bad planning and bad decisions and just no foresight in thinking about what could have been done.
If you're a city centre dweller, I'm going to presume you don't have a garden that you can hang out
in. We don't, no.
So if you want to have an outdoor summer, then the only places you can go are either public parks or like the steps of Georgian buildings in the city centre or somewhere.
And I think this is the argument I keep making at home. The parks obviously close in the evening. So if you do want to have your day, or if you're working and you want to do something in the evening, the parks are there. Obviously, you have to avoid it being an actual festival. But there are things, we could have been talking about this in February. It's too late to start talking about it now. We're in June. We're in the middle of the summer. And this is why things are happening. The other question is, we know from nightclubs that it's a really bad idea for everyone to descend on the street at the same time. So the guards closing South William Street, Stephen's Green and South Ann Street all at the same time, that's obviously going to lead to problems. And I'm not blaming the guards for having rocks thrown at them. Like, there is obviously a very bad element of people who are doing that. But there, I think there are just, I'm not a policing expert, but there seems to be bad decisions being made around everything that's happening in the evenings.
Philip Ryan, political editor of the Irish Independent. There's a lot written about it in today's papers about the general principle. Any thoughts that jump out for you this morning?
Well, the one thing is, every time we have these chats on these shows or clips go up on social media or there's items on the news, that's essentially a flyer to all the young people who are sitting at home going, no way, there's a festival on in town and loads of people are at it. I haven't done anything like that in a year and a half. So I'm going to get on the bus. I'm going to go in. I'm going to get a bag of cans.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and enjoy myself in Stephen's Green, or then I'll be pushed over into, say, William Street and have a drink there. And you can't really blame them. Like, look, the other videos that have come up online that you see, like the fights and all that, like, that's just, look, it's part and parcel of lots of people drinking. It's not a good thing. And the guards are obviously under severe pressure, and you can see what is happening to them. But the people that we have to feel sorry for is really these businesses who are only open a month, like your hair salons, your retailers. And like, to think of the Powers Court Centre, all those kind of little shops, independent shops in there who've been surviving on government grants for the last year and a half, and now they're walking into work or leaving work more likely in the evenings and seeing just gangs of people sitting on their doorsteps drinking.
And also, and a weekend where a lot of people, you know, and there's a sense that everyone's been at home for the last while, but that, you know, it's a bank holiday weekend, and a bank holiday Monday is a really important trading day for a lot of those people who wouldn't get visitors otherwise.
If you're
and they
home,
feel like they have to close early because of what's going on around them.
Exactly. And the other side is that, if you, like, while the kids are at home looking at the scenes going like, I'm getting into town, the people with the money in their pockets, with their families and kids, they're not getting up on Saturday, Sunday morning going, oh, we all go on a nice little family trip into town and spend a little time in Brown Thomas or in Grafton Street, because you're going to stumble into some young lads knocking the head off each other in the middle of the afternoon. Like, that's not going to make you want to come shopping.
Well, obviously, nobody wants to condone young lads beating heads off each other at any hour of the day, whether it's in early afternoon or anywhere else. But, and you could get into the whole debate, and maybe we will a little bit later in the hour, about how much of our socialising culture relies on alcohol, and how, by the way, it's a breach of the city bylaws to be drinking in a public area. But the one thing that I'm never sure about is whether, just because there is some antisocial behaviour or somebody throws some bottles at Gardaí, whether the appropriate response then is to close off the entire street. And we saw this during the week at the bandstand in St. Stephen's Green as well, where there was a bit of antisocial behaviour and somebody was hospitalised because it was a rowdy crowd that was there. But I don't know whether it's fair on everyone else, especially when there are only finite public spaces that you can actually hang out, that if somebody is taking the piss, frankly, that the entire street is closed off then for everyone and nobody can enjoy it.
I think it's the point that Sinead made, is that the guards seem to have thought of the first step through, which is get rid of the crowds, move them. But the second step is, well, so where do they go? They can't just disappear, and they won't just orderly get on buses and get taxis and go home. They have to go somewhere else. So it's just kind of, you're pushing them in other directions. But like, look, these are kids who've had nothing for months, a year or more. What are they supposed to do? Where are they supposed to go?
I think that's it. Like, there was actually great scenes of really nice fun being had. Like, there was, you know, teenagers and people in their 20s with a bit of music, having a dance. It was actually really lovely to be around. And that was there's comments in all the papers from a lot of people saying, actually, the daytimes are really, really nice. What happens is, in the evening, obviously, that you're getting to more alcohol being consumed, you're getting to dangerous. So I do have sympathy for the guards that if they let that continue and the streets aren't closed, like, there would be problems when it gets to 10, 11, 12, 1 a.m. The problems would escalate. And like, that's obvious. So I think we all have to have a bit of common sense and say, even if you don't want streets to be closed, even if you don't want, you know, guards to be on the streets like they were yesterday, I think you have to use a common sense and say, there's a reason that security are employed in festivals. There's a reason that there's certain rules around what you can do after midnight. So I think that's the problem. It's just when and how you do it, but I think it needs to be planned out.
But if you were going to close every public area, whether it's a bandstand or a street or a park or anywhere else, every time that it's abused by some people for antisocial behaviour, then you'd have Temple Bar would be evacuated at 11 p.m. every night during ordinary time. Harcourt Street would be totally evacuated.
Why isn't all this? It's acceptable when it's in Temple Bar. Why isn't it just
there
all
was an incident
there
in Temple Bar late last night as well, and the helicopter was going until about 1 a.m. But I think this is why it's really complex, Gav, and I think this is why you can't just have, you know, the guards are wrong or the young people are wrong here. There's just a lot of nuance in it, and there's a lot that we have to work through, including what you mentioned there is our over-reliance on alcohol. And that is really becoming clear when you talk about an outdoor summer. We're not talking about, like you mentioned, me living in the city centre. I'm not talking about bringing my parents in and like having an outdoor, like being able to sit in a park with them, because it's not really feasible at the moment. Like, that's not it. It is probably now that there are toilets and what else. But you know, the atmosphere that that's in town isn't conducive to those kind of things. We are prioritizing a more festival vibe, which includes a lot of alcohol.
How much of all of this, Philip, could have been avoided if the guards, instead of taking the, you know, the virtue of the graduated response and trying to convince people very nicely to do stuff before they then sort of move in with the slightly more aggressive tactics, if they just enforced the bylaws pretty radically from early on in the day and just said, anyone who's drinking on the street, sorry lads, no, I know you're allowed to sell a takeaway pint, but you're not allowed to consume it in a public place, so sorry lads, be on your way. And then you'd possibly avoid aggro later in the day if you don't have people drinking openly for hours first.
But then we'd be sitting here thinking about how unfair the Garda policies are on people trying to sell beer in the city centre, and how the guards are ruining our...
But that's the law,
somewhere outdoors.
Like, yeah, it might be tough going for the hospitality trade because they've been closed and, and everyone would like a very moderate and modest takeaway pint if you sit there quietly not bothering anyone. But it's the law, though.
Yeah, but most people are doing that, Gav. Like, that is the thing. Most people are actually able to have a quiet pint now, given you go most places. And like I said, most of the daytime stuff, that is what's happening. So it does feel like that is the way that we're trying, like pushing people to have the outdoor summer. It's just when it escalates, that's the problem. So I think there was videos of guards taking beer off people on South William Street late last night, and that has attracted some criticism as well.
I was checking this actually during the week, that under the City Council bylaws, Gardaí are allowed to seize alcohol if they believe that you have or are consuming that alcohol in a public place. So the presumption is that if they walk through the city centre and they see you with a bag of cans, and it's their presumption that you've already been drinking, the bylaws entitle them to seize your stuff. You're not allowed to seize the stuff if you just presume that someone is going to go and consume that in an illegal setting, whether it's on the side of the street or not. And I think that it's little things like that that have people thinking that the Garda response is a little bit heavy-handed or disproportionate relative to whatever's going on.
Yeah, I can understand why that. You've spent your hard-earned money on a couple of cans, and where you drink them should be yours as long as it's done legally. But then on the other side of things, here's a quote from the Sunday Times when they're talking about it. On Thursday night, a shopkeeper's son and a friend were assaulted by a gang of 30 after a window of their shop off Drury Street was broken. So that's the other hand. And I bet those guys probably had a couple of cans on them as well.
I think one of the big worries is next week or from tomorrow when all of the restaurants and bars will want their pathways back to seat people, to seat paying customers. And now we have got into, you know, a rhythm of, you know, the pathways are ours, the streets are ours, and not just the park. So the people have got used to bringing their, a lot of them are bringing their own, and like not everyone is buying takeaway pints. A lot of people are bringing their own from shops and off license. And so how are we going to square that, the people who want to have their outdoor summer but not, and we don't have the capacity, obviously there won't be a massive capacity in restaurants. And so I think that again is a real failure of planning. No idea what's going to happen next week when the same amount of people want to come, but all those pathways are taken up with tables and chairs.
Yeah, which then is an interesting question, Philip, as to how much of the public squares and public venues in the city are actually reliant on private businesses supporting them, and that sometimes you're allowed to sit and consume alcohol in a public space as long as you're paying for the space, which seems like a contentious policy enough as well.
Yeah, and the rates I think are cut on all these spaces, aren't they, for the time being? You don't have to, and I keep see these these makeshift public areas keep popping up all over the place. I've seen a few on Capel Street, and they're popping up on Baggot Street outside some of the pubs there, these kind of small little areas, and that's what it's going to be for the next few months. But the one thing I kind of worry about seeing happening is it's very close to the road, a lot of these places where people are expected to drink, and cars are going to be going by and people are going to be drinking.
There's going to be people spilling out, because if there's a big appetite for outdoor drinking on a bank holiday Monday, if the weather is good tomorrow, there'll be plenty of people who are outside the official kind of perimeter of the bit that you're supposed to be drinking.
And how do businesses manage that when it's not their customers? I think this is going to be a real headache from tomorrow on. Like, if customers then aren't happy that all of these teenagers and people in their 20s who have been around for the last few weeks are still there, are they going to be happy to be paying customers when this festival is going on around them? There's a lot of things that are going to clash from tomorrow.
Should they just have maybe, would it have made more sense to allow full outdoor hospitality from last Friday instead of Monday, and to have a slightly more regulated bank holiday weekend where people actually had sanctioned outdoor places that they could sit and behave modestly and not run the risk of having the guards close the street?
Yeah, I think if you saw Dublin yesterday, I think it made very little sense that the things weren't open from the Saturday of the bank holiday rather than just the Monday. It was 2 days, and it probably would have allowed for some of that planning, and like what I was saying there, that clash from tomorrow not happening, because people would have had the expectation that they should mm-hmm. be booking somewhere rather than.
But the other side of that is, I think a lot of the people who are in town, you'd wonder if they are the types or the age group that would be booking places and to sit
because it's hard to afford it. Yeah.
Well, a lot of the people that were also in town yesterday weren't of legal drinking age anyway, so that if you had outdoor hospitality opened, it wouldn't stop 16
reduce
or 17
the drinking
year
olds. Age, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. That's, the other thing they could have done, and like this is probably pie in the sky thinking, but could we have had a ticketing system for Stephen's Green, Merrion Square, all the city centre places where you could let 300, 500 people in, designate the spaces. Merrion Square have those spaces done out in the love heart shapes. You know, designate space for people that they can come in, have an outdoor space to do, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to spend money in city centre establishments. But that would have been stuff that needed to be done in February.
Anthony on Twitter says the reason for this antisocial behaviour is because the rats of our society know that there's no punishment in the courts. Their revolving door is just putting money in the pockets of the legal industry through the free legal aid system. One thought before I go to a break, Philip. I don't know whether you were at the same press conference as myself, and I can't even remember which of the marathon of government press conferences about COVID this was, but the Taoiseach saying forget about takeaway pints, forget about them, and then being asked at some length by myself and Christina Finn and others, but hang on, are you going to change the law then to ban takeaway pints? Are you going to change the licensing laws? And he just said no, just forget about them. Everyone just discouraged
for months. Wouldn't
you've gotten around a lot of the problems of the last couple of days? I know people will always buy their cans in an off license and bring them in, and you can't stop that. But a lot of the culture that the Taoiseach is now wringing his hands about would probably have been averted if they'd actually just changed the law and stopped takeaway pints if you want
to. Well, this is around December, Mark, was it? Or just after? No, sorry, into the new year. When all the pubs did it on good faith. They were allowed to do it if they wished. They could have handed them out in the middle of January at level 5 lockdown, but they didn't. And the government, for some reason, I think mostly because it's quite a technical process and it would have taken a bit of work to do to start changing the licensing act, didn't bother. And we have this scenario, and eventually, as things eased, the takeaway points came back, and the weather is obviously one of the driving forces too.
A different Anthony on Twitter says he'd like to point out to my female contributor, which is Sinead O'Carroll, that the people own the footpaths and roads as well as the parks. It's not businesses, and this is the problem. Remember that the people own the country, not the government or the medics. 53106.
Did you say that, Anthony? I said our paths.
53106 is the number for your text. On the record, NT is the hashtag on Twitter. There are a couple of certainties in Irish life. Outdoor drinking on a sunny day is one of them. Another one is taxes. There is an awful lot written in today's papers about tax of one sort or another, whether it's the reforms of the local property tax, whether it's the G7 stuff on corporate tax, whether it's Leo Varadkar urging us all to try and boost tax revenue by going out and spending a lot of savings. There is an awful lot written and it's pretty open-ended. Philip, where do you want to start, or anything that jumps out for you?
I suppose that story on the front of the Sunday Independent that Hugh O'Connell wrote off the back of a Leo Varadkar op-ed that they have in the paper, where the Taoiseach seems to be trying to put forward an air of optimism and, you know, saying everything will be fine and we're towards the end and all this. But there's also a little bit of an air of desperation off his comments, in that, like, pleading with the public to go out and spend. And it's like, for some people, that's fine. Yeah, there'll be a little bit of savings there. But as well as having those savings there, there's going to be the uncertainty in the back of people's mind that you've just gone through this trauma of a pandemic.
We've had plenty of false dawns where we thought we were over before.
Yeah, and you don't know what's going to be happening in the new year. You don't know what's going to be happening when your kids are going back to school in September. And you have the Taoiseach here saying, go out and buy yourself a brand new designer suit and then go to
fashion shoes,
Gibos for lunch, and then and then book a holiday to Clare.
Other Michelin stars, restaurants and venues are available.
Well, I'll do what I want with my savings, thank you very much.
He's talked a lot, though, in the last couple of months about this idea of the paradox of thrift, where everybody tries to act prudently and make sure that their money is there for the future. But the point he's trying to make is that your savings are someone else's income, so that unless you go out and spend your money,
then all the
retail jobs or all the hospitality jobs will all struggle, and that the country ends up just grinding to a halt altogether.
But it's the uncertainty. People don't know what's going to happen next, and the Taoiseach is telling you should throw your money at all this type of things. Like, look, there's a substantial amount of people's savings there. And we all probably have some ourselves, that just because we haven't been going out, we haven't been going on holidays, we haven't been spending on the things that we generally do. But I'd see those type of comments sitting with some people, because there's the other group of people who've been living off 350 euros a week for the last year, who are going to read those comments and go, hold on a minute, what are all these savings that the Taoiseach is talking about on the front page of the Sindo?
It's certainly maybe a two-tier economy, all right. Sinead, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the other thing is probably because of the huge stimulus package, it was about spending, the government spending money, but the headlines were about the property tax and the cuts to the PUP. So a lot of people are probably wondering, okay, is there anything else coming down the line? Opposition parties are talking about austerity, now wrongly talking about austerity, because there's obviously no austerity in a 3.5 billion stimulus package.
Although, actually, a lot of the 3.5 billion, so 2.5 billion of that was the continuation of the PUP and the different revenue supports. And then the other 1 billion was that European money,
of
which we're a net donor anyway. So we're actually not getting much. So like, although you can call it, you can call it a 3.5 billion plan, a lot of it's not really trying to expand the economy so much as to keep it on life support.
Yeah, and the 1 billion, the euro 1 billion with the green projects and the training investment, the green projects in particular are kind of aimed at growth. But you can understand why people will be worried, especially when they're kind of looking at the property tax and figuring out like which band am I in? I'm in the band who doesn't have to spend more, or the band who does. So I think that's probably
where it's coming
from.
Doesn't afflict a lot of our generation because they don't own their own property.
So the people I think the simple one was the 2013 one, and he has built since 2013. But in the paper today, there's also really, it's actually like a economics lecture kind of going through the paper today. There's some really great pieces, but you can see kind of a divide between people arguing for investment and not worrying about public debt, and then the people kind of saying, look, we need to stop this rash spending. And Aidan Regan actually pulls together his argument for all of the other pieces. He kind of predicts that there's going to be a lot of other columnists in the Sunday papers writing about how we should stop the public spending and worry about our debt to GDP ratios. So there's some really interesting stuff there about like how we should look at the future and how we should kind of go about the next few years economically and not worry so much. His argument is that we shouldn't worry so much about financial GDP or GDP to debt ratios, because it's, you know, we're the sovereign state, we're not a household. He makes the arguments. Home economics is very different, whereas a lot of people who argue for not allowing debt to build up, saying like the government is like a house, so you shouldn't lever your debt off more.
You don't ever really have to pay off, so as long as you can afford to pay it off, it's grand.
Yeah, and as long as at the moment, you know, the cost of borrowing is very, very low. So while we can do it, invest in ourselves and invest in our future, then we should. So the argument is quite compelling he makes, but then others are saying the opposite. Like Lucinda Creighton in the same paper is kind of worrying that the government is worried that that cheap money is here to stay, but it is here for the moment, so that's probably what he'd argue back to Lucinda.
Philip, strike while the iron's hot.
Just adding to the uncertainty side of things as well is what's happening over in London with the G7 financial ministers meeting. So at the same time as we're being told to spend and everything will be fine and let's go borrow loads, the G7 ministers, finance ministers, have agreed to have a 15% corporate tax rate for the globe, which would mean ours having to increase by 2.5%.
Yeah, which Pascal Donoghue says he's not going to. So having attended the meeting and being part of the deal that brokered this historic accord on tax treatment, he then comes back and takes off his European hat and puts on his Irish one and says, we're not doing that.
But are we not going to? He says it would cost us 2.4 billion to do it. But are the best boys in class in Europe really going to stand up against this forever and ever? I don't think so.
The Fiscal Advisory Council reckons it could be 3.5 billion, which is an even bigger hole which needs to be plugged somewhere. I'm surprised that there's been so little.
Who's going to pay that tax revenue?
Well, I'm surprised that there's been so little written about that, Sinead, because even aside from whether we climb down from this massive pedestal that we've built for ourselves over the last quarter of a century and we just refuse to resile from 12.5%, if there is this kind of minimum 15% rate, and more importantly, business getting taxed in the country that it happens rather than getting funneled through jurisdictions like our own, that it's in another enormous hole in our finances, that it's another 3.5 billion that either has to be borrowed from somewhere or cut from somewhere or raised somewhere else in order to balance the books, and we have absolutely no plan for how we're going to do it.
No plan, and also no appetite anywhere in politics for revenue raising taxes domestically. So I think, and that's where a lot of the other stuff from comes in today around the property tax, and there's a bit being written about VAT as well.
Yeah, we just extended the VAT cut as well, so your takeaway pints are going to be that bit cheaper for the next 15 months.
And so there was a huge amount of interest. I was actually thinking myself about the front pages and how big a meeting that was yesterday, and I was looking at the readership of our pieces last night on the Journal, and there is always huge interest in anything about changes to our corporation tax rate, because people feel very personally, I think, about our corporation tax rate, whether it should be increased or left alone, depending on where they kind of sit ideologically on economics and taxation of corporations.
I think as well, it's looked upon, you kind of forget every now and again that a lot of countries across the world see Ireland as a tax haven.
Joe Biden's always calling us a tax haven, even though he loves us.
Yeah, exactly. And you kind of forget that every now and again. There's that view of us, even just with the G7 going.
Why are we a tax haven and not Bermuda, where a lot of our subsidiaries then end up getting taxed in, which charges 0%? Like, if Bermuda changed its tax rate to even a quarter of 1%, they'd make tens of billions because of the amount of stuff that's funneled there. And yet it's always us that's pointed to as a tax haven and not the likes of them that don't levy
at all. I suppose we get the other benefit, we get the ancillary benefits of people setting up their companies here, because it's not just brass plate companies. We have a lot of people working here. We have a lot of investment in other things. We have benefits like the Pfizer beginning to manufacture their vaccine here as well. So I think we get all those little knock-on benefits as well that people could be annoyed about.
Well, what's the benefit then for us of signing up and of kind of semi-brokering this 15% corporate tax rate? Because if all of it means is that we have to raise our rate that every finance minister since time immemorial has stood up in the Dáil and said we're not changing, and by time immemorial I mean 1997 obviously, that every single minister has stood up and said we're not changing this, and now we may change it, and being made to change it, it might mean some extra revenue, but the amount that we're going to lose by companies getting taxed fairly in the country that their money is raised in, it's going to cost us billions. I don't know what the upside for this is, other than some sort of reputational restoration, which kind of then infers that you're admitting you were a tax haven all along.
Well, this is it. And are we going to believe that that's 100% what's going to happen? All these companies will just abandon us straight away that have been here years. If there was an alternative out there already that was at a... Like, there are other benefits that we provide to these companies, especially American companies, English-speaking language in the European Union. We do have those other benefits as well that attract businesses here. The corporation tax is obviously the main element. How long we can stand up for it, I don't know. It is hard. I was just with the G7 going on and Pascal Dunham being over there. I was on BBC radio trying to explain to them why we're challenging the EU to the because they want to give us 13 billion euros of tax from Apple. And why do we do that? and it is hard to explain to people that we have this thing and the country is behind the government for doing this. No to taxes. Taxing big business. So it's an unusual scenario.
Everyone's behind the government on that.
No, well, not everybody, but it's accepted, let's say.
Yeah, and there is a lot of people who are protective over because they do see the benefits of multinationals coming here and setting up. I think the Pascal Donoghue's argument about, small countries will have to be taken into consideration. I see that as being his campaign over the next few years, and probably trying to get into the ear of Joe Biden, saying, yeah, look, we know that you think Ireland is this, but, we would be in a very different position if we hadn't had
there
a 12%.
There could possibly be a weighted type of system you could introduce on it, that if you have countries with smaller GDPs,
you'd be allowed to raise slightly more. Yeah,
yeah. I'd imagine that's where his campaign is going to lie. That was the line that stuck out for me.
But why the campaign of there has to be some flexibility for small countries instead of a campaign of just trying to stop it altogether? Because the tax system as it's set up in the world right now suits Ireland very well. And when Pascal Donoghue is in this privileged position of being the president of the Eurogroup, I don't know why he's not trying to be obstinate on behalf of Ireland rather than this kind of passive opposition.
Yeah, it suits Ireland very well, but the OECD will say it's massively contributing to inequalities and inequities across the world. So I don't think Ireland, as a developed country, as a rich country, can stand by and just protect our own, especially within our position in the EU and as a country who has a UN security seat, who's always looking to increase our power and say in various diplomatic circles. So I don't think we can do that. It's very clear that the way that global tax system works now in a very different world.
Gav, you raised an interesting point earlier when you're saying that Ireland is now a net contributor to the EU.
Yeah.
And so meaning that we don't get as much back as we put in. And that's where the pressure is going to come from. So the EU is going to start putting pressure. You can see the comments there from the French finance minister today that they're pushing this. We're all in this together, lads. Everybody has to pay their fair share.
Our share of that fund, that 750 billion, it's supposed to be calculated on things like population and everything else, but also how much your economy shrank by last year, because they just presumed that every economy would shrink in headline terms in 2020. And the Irish economy grew in 2020 because of the effect of multinationals being here. Eugene on Twitter says that unless a COVID debt forgiveness is enacted across the Eurozone, Europe's in danger of collapsing. That will drive the Le Pens of Europe forward and indeed other far-right groups. Interesting, of course, to keep an eye on that with the French presidential election moving on. Before we go to a break, Philip, one other issue about tax. We didn't talk very much about the changes to the local property tax. You were first out the traps with those new tax bans after the cabinet meeting on Tuesday. How much of an issue will it be if people who feel like they have been stung by the pandemic, who are losing their PUP, whose household incomes are going to be cut, are going to find themselves having to pay a higher tax while Leo Varadkar is boasting that the millionaires in Dublin Bay South will get a reduction?
And they could be on PUP as well, and they'll see that being cut at the same time this thing is coming in. So you might have been trying to pay your mortgage with your PUP, and come February, not only will your PUP be down 150 euros, you'll also be hit with a 90 euro increase on your property tax. And I think that's when things will kick off. It's a very unusual move, our political strategy, to introduce a 90 euro tax weeks out from a by-election. Let's see how that one works out.
I know there was a lot of confusion among some people in cabinet and a little bit of reticence as to why they were introducing, or why they'd finally grasped the nettle of property tax after 4.5 years on the same day the cabinet was signing off on an extension, but also the eventual withdrawal of PUP. Some of those texts and tweets coming in to 53106 or on the record NT hashtag on Twitter. It must be depressing to be a business owner in the area, knowing that people will now just stay away from the city centre and instead stay more local to wherever they're from. That's from one tweeter who I think makes a very fair point. Barry says that what he can see happening is that Ireland on corporate tax will go to the 15% headline rate, but it will offer, quote, incentives to the companies that could bring it back down to the current 12.5 rate, which for a lot of companies is far lower than that. Don't you know there'll be some fiddle for them, he says. And Sean says that telling people to spend, this has been referenced to Leo Varadkar's piece in the Sunday Independent today, while a lot of people have to hand over the majority of their wages on rent and have little disposable income, seems to be an example of how out of touch Fine Gael are on housing. There are billions in savings, but it's the wealthy minority. Hashtag on the record NT for your comments. Before we talk about mother and baby homes, actually, Philip, we touched on Dublin Bay South before the break. There's an interesting interview with your colleague Hugh O'Connell with Deirdre Conroy, the Fianna Fáil candidate today.
Yeah, definitely. She's been in the news this week for a couple of different incidents. One was this blog that was dug up from a few years back where she was making some questionable comments about being a landlady and having lodgers in her house from Lithuania and Latvia, I think. Mm-hmm. And the other was a case she took on foot of an accident she had on a ski trip.
Now, which seems, by virtue of Hugh's interview today, to have been actually quite a significant injury she incurred.
Oh, certainly. There's pictures there in the paper, and it was a very serious injury. It does seem, and look, it's an ongoing case, and it's best not to delve into that too much, I would say. But I see one of the tone from this article, and something that I've noticed from politicians and political parties on at a whole, and their supporters in recent times, is this offence that they take when part of their life is scrutinised or examined, when they want to take up an office or want the taxpayers of this country to pay them for their job, and for them in that job, for some of them, to decide how taxpayers' money is spent. So
in this instance, do you mean Deirdre Conroy taking offence at people pulling up her old blogs from 2013
exactly.
and 14?
Exactly.
She was in public life. It was before she was even an elected member of Dublin City Council. It was before she was even a member of Fianna Fáil.
Is
it still
relevant? Everything that happens in your life informs who you are, and everything should be taken into account. And voters, most importantly, have a right to know all these things when someone is going before them, seeking a 96,000 euro salary and seeking to go vote on laws that affect every aspect of our lives.
Are you surprised that the blog was still up there, that no one else had sort of intervened and done a little bit of an audit before she got nominated?
Any of this stuff with politicians these days, that kind of, they seem to have this memory lapse that end, like you're saying, anything that happened before they go just didn't happen and isn't all over. Like, you've seen it so many times with people and their Twitter comments, their Facebook comments and
it's
blogs.
It's a real lack of preparedness by the parties as well. Like, it speaks to me like they find people who they think could be good candidates but don't prepare them in any way. They're not told about, like, oh, this is what the media scrutiny will be like, and it's completely fair. This is what you should do to prepare yourself in terms
of
your previous social media.
Have you written it mad on social media ever? if you have,
well, they clearly don't think it's mad. That's why it's there. But Sinead, are we kind of getting though to a tipping point where, not that there's too much attention paid or the appropriate scrutiny to what goes on in people's previous lives or what they might have written or said in public forums, but that because the internet has just been around for long enough now that pretty much anyone who wants to enter public life is going to have some body of work on a blog or on a live journal or on an old Bebo page that someone's got archived or on Twitter, where basically everyone has said something a bit embarrassing and mortifying that's going to be dug up, and that we maybe need to be a bit more mindful about how everyone says stuff that they don't agree with anymore.
Yeah, but I agree with Philip that it's up to voters to decide then what is relevant to them and what's not. Like if I was voting and someone's blog post or Bebo messages had popped up and it was from 10, 15 years ago, I probably could decide whether I could discount even if I disagreed with opinions or, you know, and said, okay, someone has moved on from that, or that was ridiculous, but probably I can see why that would happen in the year 2000 and not in 2021. But I do think, like, if it exists and it's part of people's body of work, it is okay for the media, and it's responsible for us to have a look in it and see what is in
it. It gives a glimpse into people that that they're not willing to put out, that a lot of these candidates can, on the other side of it, be so polished and everything is done through media training that you don't find out all these other secret elements of their lives that they probably is, which is the true person.
Like, it's all stuff that's public. It's not like you're going through, it's not like going through people's bins.
It's terrible that we both immediately reach for the going through the bins. Someone called the Mole of Marlborough Street, who presumably has all the goings on in the Department of Education, gets in touch via Twitter to say that the public health advice is think outdoors, not drink outdoors, or even just go outdoors. Read the room, everyone. And TJ says, as regards corporate tax, that the 15% tax rate doesn't create uncertainty. It guarantees absolute certainty. It means that nobody can undercut us. No multinational gets any advantage by leaving Ireland, because no other jurisdiction would be lower. It would even increase the tax take, says TJ, which is reasonable
if it all works, if everybody does it.
But if Bermuda doesn't, and Bermuda keeps the 0%, then I don't know what sort of
it is.
Shape
one of the points that has come up a lot in the papers today about wealth taxes and how to, you know, fairly tax people, because the more wealth you have, and this counts for individuals as well as companies, the more wealth you have, more access to being able to figure out how to hide that wealth legally and make sure that you don't have to pay taxes to either the country you're resident in or the country you're actually resident in or the country you want to be resident in.
Is it Colin McCarthy who's making that point in the Sunday Independent today, talking about wealth taxes and how wealth taxes only really work if the wealth is immobile, and therefore the only real wealth that people have that they can't move offshore is their house. And unfortunately, if it means taxing family homes, then so be it. But that if you live in a very expensive house that you could probably afford to run, then... Maybe
he does make the argument that there is design flaws in the local property tax, in that, you know, obviously there will be some incomes that don't match the asset. So there will be a mismatch, particularly in Dublin homes. And that also you are penalised if you increase the value by maybe, you know, retrofitting it to make it more environmentally friendly. So that he was saying that there could be things to, which is a good argument, that if you actually make your house greener, that maybe you should pay a lower property tax than rather than a higher one, because you've added a value to it.
We don't have as much time as I would have liked to go through some of the pieces that are written today about mother and baby homes, about the failure to commit to any redress, but also just about its conduct and how betrayed some of those who gave testimony actually feel. Philip, in the couple of minutes we have, anything that jumps out for you today?
Taking in the whole topic that has been this week, like, the two points that stand out to me is, number one, why did Professor Mary Doyle Daly-Rutter decide that it was necessary to do that seminar? Why did she feel that was the appropriate thing to do? And the other side,
is it not appropriate to be transparent and to talk to people and to discuss your approach?
Why not do it in the front of the Oireachtas if you wanted to get out there and say that was the opportunity was always there and it was resisted? So that'd be number one. And number two, I always feel a little bit uncomfortable. Like people deserve answers, and the people who were drafted up in the mother and baby homes controversy and just scandal over the years deserve answers and deserve transparency. But I always do get a bit uncomfortable when political leaders are demanding private citizens to come before committees and it's kind of this approach where you have the leader of the country, the deputy leader of the country, standing up in the Dáil demanding people submit themselves to these Oireachtas hearings, which they cannot be compelled for, and they cannot be compelled for a reason.
And that they can't be compelled because the commission is dissolved and because therefore they are private citizens. But there was once upon a time, Sinead, when they were running a commission that had been set up by the Oireachtas, and there are clearly some defects in what they submitted to the Oireachtas, so shouldn't they be called in? in.
Yeah, and one of the things we're learning, like we learned a lot from the Ryan Commission and all the other tribunals that we've held over the years. And one of the things that we had for this commission was to try and not make it as legally problematic for the witnesses, and to make sure that things could get done in a kind of more efficient manner. So, but we also could be doing, it doesn't mean that we have to stick to that rigidly. And a lot of academics would argue that now about this commission. We learned those things 10, 15 years ago. We have learned other things from other jurisdictions. Mm. It would have been made way more sense that as part of the commission, the commission's authors would have had to speak immediately after the report, or even 2 or 3 weeks after the report, when the people who were involved got a chance to read it, had obviously would have had questions. And that would have been a very appropriate form. It's entirely inappropriate form for Mary Daly to have gone to a webinar in Oxford, for the women to have been able to sit in and listen to it but not be able to question.
And even the scramble to be able to get the Zoom link in the first
place. And obviously some of her comments then also created, you know, more hurt and more questions, especially because she was one of three. So you would imagine the other two could have probably provided more insights, especially around some of the comments she made about the legal side of things, because she was coming at it from the historical side of things. Eilish O'Hanlon and Catherine Connolly both have great pieces on the first page of the Sindo opinion pieces today. Eilish O'Hanlon's kind of saying what Philip was saying there about you know, not compelling people to come before a committee because it's actually just a lot of political grandstanding that you'd agree with. But there are a few questions that Catherine Connolly says need to be answered. When and how did the commission decide on its interpretation of what could be done with the confidential committee? That for me is the key question, because if they knew at the very start, they could have done a lot about it. And that would be something that I would be keen to find out in some appropriate form.
If they do attend the committee, we're completely out of time. Philip Ryan and Sinead O'Carroll, thank you both very much for joining me.